It's the Rick Emerson Show. Live from Portland at 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. Rick. I'm getting emails about things hours ago. Rick, you poor Portlander. The Shanghai was still being practiced in Portland after the Second World War. In fact, the Navy was brought in to prevent merchant marine vessels from using Shanghai tactics. One of the largest tombstones in the Morrison Pioneer Cemetery is for the city's most well-known Shanghaier. He even sold off his son because his son was, quote, not good for much of anything else. All right, there you go. That's one of those things, and it sounds like someone like we're setting up some sort of a bit or whatever, but that's just one of those things I got to do. I've never
been Shanghai.
I've never seen the. Yes, yeah. I've got to be stuffed in a box and sent to China.
Yeah, the ones we went under, it was underneath Hobos, which is on Southwest 3rd. Mm-hmm. Under Hobos, and then under the boiler room.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it was really cool. There's opium den that they showed in like these piles of shoes because they would take off all the shoes.
Opium looks fantastic. So watching this whole thing on the Discovery Channel. No, kids, don't do opium. You can't even do opium anymore. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't. Right? There's no, where would you even buy opium? But I was watching this whole Discovery on the History Channel. I urge you, by the way, to watch this program about drugs. Wait, hold on. Speaking of drugs, we gotta take a, here. I have to finish this coffee. I'm going to drink my coffee. While I'm doing that, I'm going to play you the rapping traffic reporter.
Jenny has traffic.
All right. I'm all nervous, but here's my rap. Ahem. All right, you're going to have a good, good drive today. There ain't no problems on the major roadways. Looking at country club, things will look pretty good like Robin Hood. Now I'm moving across the triad, yo. It ain't too bad. No. Now things look nice on 68, and I know you ain't going to be late. So that was your traffic wrap today. Man, let's get some weather from my weather girl. Austin Cavanaugh's, come on, give us a weather boy. Give it to us, word.
Oh, boy, Jenny, it's weather guy, by the way. That is something.
All right, there you go.
Why did you do that to us?
I had to drink my coffee, and I didn't want to play the Starbucks song again. I don't want to overplay
it. At least it wasn't Bill Cosby.
No, I got that, too. There's this great series on the History Channel called, it's called Hooked, and it's a five-part series about drugs that are illegal. It's called Hooked. It's called Illegal Drugs and How They Got That Way. And each installment is about a different drug, heroin, LSD, marijuana, cocaine, whatever. And it's about how that drug came to be in existence and came to be illegal. And they do this whole thing about opium, and it looks fantastic. Which I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it's bad, and you shouldn't do it. But I'm saying it's one of those drugs, the description of which is, it's enough to give one pause. But then you see that. But then you see that From Hell movie, and you see Johnny Depp just dying with no teeth and pennies on his eyes, and that's, you don't want to do that. Anywho, so I gotta go through the Shanghai tunnels one of these days. It's a thing I gotta do.
It was very cool.
Okay, moving on.
Except for I can't breathe now.
Okay. It's 503-733-2970. Here's what's coming up. Bottom of the hour, Peter Carlin will be here from the Oregonia. We're going to talk about The Sopranos, which is not done, but it is now on hiatus until January because they are bastards. And they'll come back in January with the final 8 episodes, which I hope, by the way, are better than what we've gotten this season so far. Last night was actually really good. I liked last night was the best season or best episode of the season so far, but overall it's been kind of lackluster. But they're going to make up for it, by the way, this coming Tuesday, or I guess a week from tomorrow, when Entourage is going to be back. So we'll talk about that with Peter Carlin. We've got the top five we'll do here in a few, top five Zeppelin guitar intros of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, let us go to the city desk with your personal savior, Tim Riley.
From high atop the bottom of the coin tower in downtown Portland, Oregon, CBS presents the City Desk Newsbeat, Tim Riley reporting. Former Portland City Council candidate Emily Boyles must repay more than $100 million in public campaign funds, rules an Oregon judge.
Boyles.
She'll have to pay $144,905. She received a public financing and $14,000 in penalties plus 12% interest.
She looks like a person I wouldn't trust with my money.
Well, for one thing, if you're going to run for politics, at least get yourself an office before you start doing this stuff. You don't start by doing it.
You're trying to get a leg up in the I'll steal early on so that I don't have to worry about it later.
She was penalized in April, and her funding was revoked when she was cited for violations of spending guidelines by prepaying for a one-year lease. She was also cited for additional penalties for paying too much for the services of her daughter.
She was trying to get like a rolling start with the corruption.
Yeah.
Didn't she pay her daughter like $14,000?
Yeah, she did.
Sitting there and surfing MySpace, essentially? All right. Yep.
So that's that. So the lesson here to be learned is wait till you get in office.
There you go.
Meanwhile, Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy says he'll heal with addiction one day at a time. Mm-hmm. In his first public appearance since going into rehab.
Isn't this like the fourth time he's been in rehab?
No, I don't think so. You think of his dad.
I'm pretty sure that he's been in rehab.
Wait, hold on. I don't have the old Inquirer. We never did read that old Inquirer story where it showed that woman taking shots out of his navel.
Oh, yeah.
Did we ever read that, or did I just show
I
you the picture?
You showed me the picture.
Sure, he looks like a recessy Annie doll. This is photographic proof. We'll get it. I'll read it later. He's on his back, salt in his navel, shot glass on his stomach, and like some co-ed, as they used to call them, some co-ed taking shots off of him. And apparently he was, this may be wrong, but if memory serves correctly, he was in rehab at least once before, I believe, for a cocaine problem.
Oh, it's possible, yeah. He's a Kennedy.
He is a Kennedy, yeah.
He maintains he wasn't drinking that night and argues that it is a moot point because addiction is the same for him, whether it's alcohol or any other mood-altering substance.
Whatever it's not whether it's alcohol or Ambien. I should not have been taking Ambien. It says on the directions, do not operate heavy machinery under this drug. Phenergan says the same thing.
He's not as good as his dad.
No, he's completely inconvenient. He lacks the Kennedy smoothness that his father has.
Meanwhile, Penelope Cruz is single again.
I had no idea she was even... Did you know that she was dating Matthew McConaughey?
For a long time now.
I was never appraised of this fact. I had no idea. It was whenever they broke up, I had no idea they were even together.
Well, the couple became romantically involved while filming Sahara together.
That's the best movie ever.
Yeah. They blame the heavy workload for the surprising breakup.
Also the fact that she looks like some sort of a stick creature.
In a statement, they said, we have decided to take time off as a couple. Due to busy work schedules and so much time apart, we mutually decided 4 weeks ago, instead of years, that separated us was the best thing to do.
I thought that she had... Didn't she lost her celebrity status? And you have to make a movie at least once every couple of years to remain a celebrity? What is the last thing she was in?
She has some movie coming out with Selma Hayek.
Nobody cares.
I think they make out in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was just...
See, they care.
Look how easy it is to win me over. Look what a stupid pinheaded male I am. Because I was just going to say, that seems like an ill-advised move when you're basically an ugly version of Selma Hayek to begin with. You know what I mean? That's a... Penelope, and look, I'm not saying this to be cruel, but we must speak of these things honestly if we are to have a dialogue about them. Penelope Cruz and Selma Hayek are sort of the Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger syndrome. You know, they're kind of the twins thing. It's like when you see one ugly sister and like one really hot sister.
Yes.
Penelope Cruz is the ugly sister in that relationship. She's like the fat guy in Good Charlotte. And Selma Hayek is... And I don't care how old Selma Hayek is. Guys can talk whatever they want about when a woman hits 30 or 35, she can't be hot anymore. Selma Hayek is still like the hottest thing on earth. Everyone knows that to be true. It doesn't matter. And Penelope Cruz is weird-looking and has always been weird-looking. And Matthew McConaughey, isn't he? Matthew McConaughey is one of those guys, he must just wake up every morning and just bow down to the genetic pool that created him because he doesn't really have a lot of acting skill. Doesn't really seem like he's a master thespian. He doesn't have to. He's just one of those guys. Matthew McConaughey is one of those guys. He will be 150 years old, and women will still find him hot. I was in my office the other day, and I witnessed a bunch of women in the sales department just cackling on all morning about how hot Matthew McConaughey was. He's one of those guys, you could just roll him in mud, and women would still find him attractive. It's like Jennifer Connelly used to be for guys. You cover her with spiders, she's still gorgeous. So, there you go. So, Jerry, good to be him, sucks to be her.
Meanwhile, Oprah Winfrey is about to receive the custom-built $42 million executive jet she ordered for Bombardier Aerospace. A Canadian newspaper says the talk show's production company Harpo is paying for the Global Express XRS jet, which will have seating for 10 passengers. It'll be typically equipped for a jet with such a price tag of $42 million. It'll have a beautiful leather interior and designer features for the bathroom and galley, among other high-end trimmings. It'll be just like Steven Spielberg's plane, Bill Gates' plane, and the founder of Cirque du Soleil, Guy LaLiberty.
Are we really talking about Oprah's plane?
Yes, we are.
All right. Okay.
Time now for the Geek Watch.
Here's your Geek Watch from London.
Ugh, this high-speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember, you used to...
Just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but... Because we were wondering if the quantum flux... Now, just listen on
there. There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn ship. You got it?
Energize.
This is a three-parter because we have it in a couple
Fantastic.
Days.
Fantastic.
First, if Ted Owen of the Global Gaming League gets his way, the competitive video gaming will be a demonstration sport at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing. People aren't watching the Olympics that much anymore, he says. You need to bring younger viewers back if you want to keep making money. To do that, we need to embrace non-traditional games. They did it with snowboarding, and look how popular that is, Serge, in the games.
I think you should actually have to get off the sofa for something to be considered a sport.
Oh, that too. Video games deserve to be a non-traditional sport that would bring back to the games that age group that everyone understands.
Yeah, whatever.
Record-turned filmmaker Rob Zombie is resurrecting Mike Myers as one of the big screen's favorite horror victims.
Fantastic. This is the best news all week, by the way. Mondays, it doesn't matter. I don't care what other news stories come out this week. This is the best geek news of this week.
Zombie will write and direct a new Halloween movie, serving up what is being called a brand new version of the long-running horror series. He will also serve as producer and music supervisor. An October 2007 release is planned. Disney's Miramax Films will co-finance the project. The movie will not be a sequel to a straight-ahead remake of the 1978 original, which helped director John Carpenter cement his name in the horror business, but a re-imaging that will infuse new blood into the Myers story.
This is fantastic, and I am not a huge fan of the movies that Rob Zombie's. The Devil's Rejects is a good film. House of a Thousand Corpses is terrible, but despite what the geek community would have you believe. But it doesn't matter, because good, bad, or indifferent, the thing about Rob Zombie is Rob Zombie takes it seriously. He is a true believer, and so he's a guy who's going to approach that franchise with respect, because Halloween, they've made 7, 8, how many Halloween?
I don't know, looking over at Tim,
how many even Halloween, the original Halloween is one of the top 10 horror films of all time. Halloween 2, not bad. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, terrible. Halloween 4, Return of Michael Myers, yes, no, maybe, that's okay, that's good. Yeah. Halloween 5, the something of Michael Myers, that's bad. Halloween 7, it's getting fuzzy. Nah, it's, well, whatever. Anyways, they lost me after 6. But I will, I'd buy tickets for this right now. If you were to ask me, if you were to pick one person to remake the Halloween film, it would be Rob Zombie. So I put my trust in him.
And now the final Geek Watch story. You've blasted the aliens, now buy the soundtrack. Video Games Live, a symphony of compositions from computer games such as Halo, Tron, Sonic, Zelda, Mario, and the World of Warcraft is going on tour. The world tour is due in Australia late October or early November. Imagine Beethoven with lasers, lights, video, all synchronized, said creator and video game music composer Tommy Tallarico. And it's a great way to introduce a new generation of people to live symphony. Music from games such as Halo, World of Warcraft, Sonic, Zelda, Mario, and Tron is played by a 60-piece orchestra backed by a 30-person choir with a laser and stage show.
It's fantastic.
We get the symphony crowd as well. It's something the whole family can enjoy, said Mr. Tallarico.
Okay, there you go. There's your triple Geek Watch for I will not embarrass us all by singing large sections of the Halo score right now. There's your Geek Watch for Monday.
By Grafdar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
We got a couple of clarifications. Rick, you're completely off your rocker. Joseph interpreted the dreams you were thinking of. King David had Bathsheba's husband killed so he could marry her. Daniel went into the lion's den.
What video game is that?
There really ought to be a God video game. There really ought to be one of those. Let's see. David interpreted for King Solomon, blah, 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 blah.
I remember David and Goliath. That's the only David I remember from the world of religion.
Let's see. What else do we have here? Just trying to get through all of these emails. Rick, Condi Rice is not attractive. She looks like one of those aliens from V, a reptilian that can unhinge her jaw and swallow rabbits whole. There you go. Condi Rice is a dog, says Mike. He says, I will take the ugly salt and pepper girl over her any day. Let's see. What else do we have? Rick. Do you really want to know what most Star Trek internet porn sounds like?
Oh, yes.
Sarah? Sure. All right. This is from, let's see, where did the whole thing with the... This is from Aaron.
Hold me like you did by the lake on Naboo.
Rick, pleased to be telling Sarah that most Star Trek porn is written this way. Sample opening phrase. Jesus. Sample opening phrase. Kirk and Sulu had been stuck on planet M1-113 for over a week. The Enterprise was long since gone. The captain had never seen his helmsman in such a light before. His flesh glistening under the twin suns. Okay, I can't read anymore.
Oh, you gotta keep going.
No, I can't. I have to move on. Let's see. Rick.
How much of that did he actually write, or did he copy and paste it?
You know, I'm not going to ask.
Okay.
It's like you're assuming that I would know, like I would have intimate knowledge of that.
I don't know. You see, we're a little flustered that Tim and I hadn't read any of it.
Rick, FYI, I saw a porn picture a while back that looked exactly like Condoleezza Rice. You could tell it wasn't her because of the 5 o'clock shadow and oversized unit. Okay. What else do I have here? Anyway, one more, and then we got to do the top five. Let's see. Okay. Now these are all dangerous toys calls. It's 503-733-2970. It's the Rick Emerson Show. Let us now roll your top five from Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting is the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy.
I love to count,
don't you?
Don't you? Here's Tim Riley at the City Desk with today's top five.
After the bitter distress caused by our top five stone guitar intros list, we thought it would be best to take another run at the guitar intro assessment game. And although we may once again be the victims of scorn, we will do our best to rank these, the top five Led Zeppelin guitar intros of all time, with honorable mention going from Physical Graffiti, Sick Again.
These are the top five Zeppelin guitar intros of all time. Honorable mention. Physical Graffiti, which is the greatest of all Zeppelin albums, by the way. You can tell it's Robert Plant because all of his lyrics are unintelligible. It's just a lot of grunting. Just a lot of grunting and carnal wailing. Also because it contains the line, one day soon, you're going to reach 16. You could... The vast bulk of these age references, you could never get away with them. It's a fantastic song. I believe, if memory serves right, this is actually the final song on Physical Graffiti. This is the last song, side two, I think. There's a huge, thick sound, even now. We're counting down the top five Led Zeppelin guitar intros of all time.
Number five from Led Zeppelin 3, it's the Immigrant Song.
This doesn't technically count as a guitar intro, I guess, because either the bass and the drums are right there, but listen to that there. What are you going to do? Come on, how great is that? This is still the best thing ever recorded. Yeah. Only Robert Plant can make these lyrics not seem ridiculous. This is a whole lot of raising your goblet of rock right here. Without this, there'd be no Barracuda by Heart, by the way. You can practically see the Viking helmet if you close your eyes. Counting down the top five Zeppelin guitar intros of all time.
Number four, from Presence, Nobody's Fault But Mine.
This is a great song, by the way. Presence is kind of an overlooked Led Zeppelin album. Presence has Achilles' Last Stand, T for One, Hot Sun for Nowhere. Listen to this buildup. This is a song that many Zeppelin fans believed was about their deal with the devil, incidentally. Sort of their version of Robert Johnson's Crossroads. Sorry, Sarah looked over and was making my rock face.
What's the face? That was so weird.
I'm rocking out. Come on.
We're rocking out over here.
Robert Plant sang this whole album in a wheelchair. He was in a full body cast.
Number
Like all Zeppelin songs, it has a 14-minute intro.
Yeah, I'm like, does it ever start?
This is kind of why punk had to happen, because like a Ramones album would be dumb by now. Okay, that's badass, though. I don't care who you are, that's badass. Counting on the top five Zeppelin guitar intros of all time.
From number three, it's Led Zeppelin II, Heartbreaker.
It's like Beetlejuice. If we keep playing these, we're going to conjure Iris Harrison. She's going to appear in the studio. Boy, that's just grungy and grimy and fantastic and great there. I can't even tell you how many hours I spent as a child. It probably goes into the triple digits. Number of hours I spent locked in my room listening to this, whipping my stupid mullet around as I air guitared. Different smiles. Boy, that's pretty much the best thing ever. Counting down the top five Led Zeppelin guitar intros of all time. Tim Rattle?
At number two, from Houses of the Holy, Over the Hills and Far Away.
I don't like this song at all.
I don't either.
It's not your favorite part of the Zeppelin oeuvre.
It is.
I don't really care for Houses of the Holy at all, actually. Houses of the Holy has got, it's got No Quarter. It's really the only good song on it.
It's sacrilegious.
But every guitar player, look, I'm just going to, everybody who ever hung out in, like, the drama class or whatever, there was some long-haired guy in, like, 1989 who would sit there with an acoustic guitar, and he would just play this over and over again.
One big BS.
Oh, that was funny. No, he would just play this. Over and over for, like, 3 hours, trying to impress any women who happened to walk by. I mean, it kind of is, this is the Zeppelin riff that you use to try to impress people. Not a good song, but, you know, what are you going to do? All right, counting down the top five Led Zeppelin guitar intros of all time.
At long last, we come to number one from Led Zeppelin II, It's a Whole Lot of Love.
That was genius. Come on, how great is that? And it's great because it's simple. Simple, but rockin'.
You need cooling, baby, I'm not cooling. I'm gonna sit, yeah.
It's the most ridiculous lyrics.
Back to schooling.
What does you need cooling even mean?
Honey, you need
way down inside.
I'm gonna give you my love. I'm gonna give you my love. Oh, what a whole lot of love.
Yeah. Completely great. Ruined by all their subsequent live performances of it, in which this song was stretched to like 49 minutes. But what are you going to do? All right, 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. The Rick Emerson Show, live from Portland. All right, there you go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let us now welcome to the Rick Emerson Show. Ooh, you can turn me back up. From the Oregonian, our good friend, TV critic, Peter Carlin. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm good, but you know, I never did like Zeppelin that much.
Well, what are you going to do? You're what?
I did see them perform.
You're too busy, like, laying away for the Ryan Adams box set, probably. I know your kind, Peter Carlin.
You can't even perceive my kind.
You were busy bowing down to a Paul Westerberg poster.
In the 70s?
Not in the 70s. What did you you were a Stones guy, probably.
I was definitely a Stones guy, for real. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a real distinction between Stones guys and Zeppelin guys. I was also a Who guy.
It is really true. I mean, because I've talked forever about how, you know, it's like if you're a guy growing up, you were either a Ginger guy or a Marianne guy. And if you were, you know, a girl, you were either Han Solo or Luke Skywalker, you know, in terms of who you were attracted to. But it is the same thing in music, and there was that whole Metallica, Megadeth, and Led Zeppelin, Stones, or, you know, and... And it's true. And so they shared a record label, but those bands were really fiercely competitive with each other.
Yeah.
And Zeppelin never got any critical acclaim. It's just the people like you sneered and mocked, Peter Carlin.
I was 14 at the time. But I did see them play. Did you get that part
did
where
you,
I saw them play?
You saw Zeppelin?
Yeah, I just told you.
Okay, look, you bastard. I was trying to think of something cutting and glib to say.
You're not even listening to what I'm saying. What about my feelings?
I don't bring you flowers anymore. When did you see them?
1977.
77, so that would have been like the Presence album. That would have been around that time, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, was it good?
I think so.
I mean, I got to say, and I'm a huge Zeppelin fan. There are a few bigger Zeppelin fans than myself, but I have to tell you that based upon the evidence, the empirical evidence that I've seen a bunch of bootlegs and whatever, Zeppelin was real hit and miss, because they were just, and their greatness was also their weakness in that they were just so kind of sloppy and by the seat of their pants, as opposed to the Stones, the Stones thing was tightness in a lot of ways, because they had
that. Not back then, my little friend.
I wasn't there. I'm just saying, based upon the evidence that I have seen.
The Stones didn't turn slick and consistent until that 89 tour.
Yeah, but didn't they have that huge horn section and whatnot even then? It's like they had to be a little tighter than Zeppelin,
guys,
I think.
Guys on horns. But it was, but Keith was ripped on smack the whole time.
Yeah, good times.
Till about, and you can listen to tapes or bootlegs of that 78 tour, and they were pretty raw here and there, which made it exciting and cool. Actually, I take it back. I saw the Stones in 81, and they were pretty, even by that point, they were kind of, you know, the rough edges were pretty much buffed off. That was when they did the first big commercial endorsement thing with Joe Vaughn.
Yeah, oh, that's right. And was that the tour where Mick was on a cherry picker in like a bright yellow leotard?
Well, he was, and I took a beautiful picture of him up there.
Oh, that's terrible.
I'll show it to you someday.
Sort of like Robert Plant impersonating Freddie Mercury. Or so it seems to me. And you know, the thing is, that we've completely gotten off track. Growing up, I was actually not a huge Stones fan. I didn't dislike them, but I was just, in my hometown, you know, you seem bigger than Jesus. You know the story. It was that little town in Footloose where there was real no rock to speak of, and nobody played the Stones on the radio. And so I just, like, if I didn't hear about it from a guy at school, like, it never occurred to me to investigate it. And so I was actually a lot older than most people when I first really discovered the Stones.
Yeah.
And, man, I remember, this actually segues really well into what I'm going to bring up. But I remember the first time I heard Sticky Fingers and Let It Bleed, those albums. Somebody had given me, it was a tape, and, like, on one side was Sticky Fingers, mm-hmm. and the other side was Let It Bleed. And, man, I remember the first time I heard Gimme Shelter, and it was like, people say it's like seeing God, but it wasn't. It was like seeing the devil. It was seeing the devil appear in the flesh in front of, like, I could smell the brimstone. Such a great song. Such a great song. So, to this day, we did the top five Stones guitar intros of all time a couple weeks ago, and that was number one.
Where was Brown Sugar in
that? Brown Sugar was number three, I think.
Is that right? And then you put Satisfaction or something as number
Satisfaction two? Was, yeah, because even though I'm so beyond burned out on that song, I forget the order, but it was Tumbling Dice, Satisfaction, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Brown Sugar, Gimme Shelter, and I can't remember what the sixth one was. We had an honorable mention.
Before I heard it like 300,000 times, I always did dig that opening riff to Start Me Up.
Start Me Up is good, especially when you consider that it started as a reggae song.
Yeah, which I'd never heard that. If there's a bootleg of that, I've never heard it. But the thing is, the amazing thing about that tune is that I remember in the summer of 1981, I was driving. I still remember where I was in the Madison Park neighborhood of Seattle, Washington, in my friend's VW. You know, it's like that vivid.
Yeah.
We were sitting there listening to the radio, going to the beach, and suddenly you just hear those, you know, it was like, oh my God, I think the Stones have a new album coming. It was like that. That's all it took.
I kind of regret not hearing them more. The only Stone song that I was ever really familiar with when I was a kid, because my dad had the 45, was Honky Tonk Women. And that's one of those moments that was actually in an early version of Bigger Than Jesus that I actually cut before we filmed it. But that story where I found my dad's 45 of Honky Tonk Women, or my sister's, I think it was, and my dad was like passed out, my mom was gone, and I put it on the record player. I'm like, what's this? This seems interesting. And my mom came home like 2 hours later, and I had just been playing it nonstop for
that's
2 hours.
The greatest ever cowbell intro.
Oh man, and it's like, and it sounds like there's about five guitars playing at once.
It's the most lascivious cowbell ever.
And it's
something about the rhythm of it, which is just sort of like it's all sex and Satan, just all all wrapped up in one little
punk. That's the Stones right there. I mean, it's like dark, evil, sex, and voodoo, and even as a kid, I could tell that Mick Jagger had like this throwaway, just didn't care what you thought nastiness.
Yeah.
And even though I was probably 12 maybe, and so I didn't really know what a lot of sex terms were, there was no doubt that when he said, you know, I laid a divorcee in New York City, and it was just said with that, like, F you if you don't like this.
Well, and also, the last album like that in their entire catalog is Some Girls.
Yeah.
Which was the last album of theirs, which seemed, like, scary and dangerous.
Right, right.
After that, it was all pretty much showbiz.
Yeah.
But that was the one, I mean, and with that title track and that line.
That line about the...
Black girls, which is, like, hateful on one... Except there's no real... They don't present as racist. There's nothing particularly racist about it. It's obviously a racial generalization, which is accompanied by a million other racial and cultural generalizations, which takes the sting out of it. But the fact that he knows that's like going to make people freak out, pleasure.
And the line that we're referring to, and I will make this radio friend, there is a line in Some Girls in which Mick Jagger, and this is I'm now quoting Mick Jagger, by the way. These are not the observations of the Rick Emerson Show. But Mick Jagger has a line about, is it black girls just want to blank all night? That's the line, right?
There's a get in there, too.
They want to get blanked all night. Yeah, and so I...
And then he shrugs and says that he just doesn't have that much jam.
Well, and it's like, and Jagger, you get the feeling that he's just basing that on his, like, imperial, like, that's his, just his life experience. Like, well, what are you gonna do, right? You know, it's like that, well, it's like, in Brown Sugar, where, you know, that, which you could never get away with now, where the opening line of Brown Sugar, he says, you know, Gold Coast slave ship bound for New Orleans, sold in the market, or
bound for cotton.
So bound for cotton fields, sold in the market down in New Orleans. Like, you could never say that now.
Or how about the scarred old slaver, know he's doing all right, hear him with the women just around midnight. I mean, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah, you could never say that now, but you know what? KJON's probably playing the song right now.
I know, but the best part is, and then later, when they began to play it live, and I don't know if there were actually any, officially released versions of this, but the part where he says, brown sugar, how can it taste so good, he would substitute, just like a black boy should. I mean, I think just to piss off the people who weren't already pissed off.
And I mean, he can only get away with it because he's Mick Jagger and they're not. I mean, it's, you know, what are you going to do? So
that was back in the day.
Hey, speaking of the Rolling Stones, Moonlight Mile.
Yes, Moonlight Mile, which...
Wait, hold on. Sarah, we're going to be discussing The Sopranos now. There's really nothing, there are no spoilers really to speak of. You should stay. There's nothing really stunning happened. Nothing that was not already in the works.
I don't know what's in the works or not. Look, this is the last time I'm going to have to leave.
I'll come summon you.
Thank you.
All right.
You don't have to do this for like a year.
The last rock trivia moment for this conversation is that Moonlight Mile is the first and maybe the last Stones tune that had no participation whatsoever from Keith Richards.
Is that true?
Absolutely true. That was in the nadir of his smacked out days.
Yeah.
And I think I read somewhere that you know, the test pressing for the record came and he saw, like, Moonlight Mile, what the hell is that?
I think there's a couple of songs on Bridges to Babylon that he's not on.
By then,
no one cares. I was noting this last night, actually, that not just The Sopranos, but HBO in general, having done the Bigger Than Jesus, I view music licensing in a whole different way, and I'm impressed when anybody's able to do it. But Entourage is another program. They are so heavy on the Stones on that show. Entourage, like every other episode, has got like a couple really recognizable Stones songs. So The Sopranos, and somebody I noticed that on message board last night, somebody made this. They said, hey, you're all using so many Rolling Stones songs, which is so great. The soundtrack to The Sopranos is so good. And they open and close with Moonlight Mile, and I thought last night was a very... I've dogged this season, but last night was a great episode.
Yeah, and can I just point out the beautiful moment when the line of... when he takes the frozen head out of the freezer, and right at that moment the line says from the song is, with a head full of snow.
Yeah. I mean, that showed so much craft and care.
Yeah.
Goes into that program. And last night, and that whole plot line with Christopher and Juliana Margulies.
Beautiful.
But what
I love the best part there was when they're sitting around, they're totally skagged out, lying there on the sofa, talking about how cool it is that they could, like, work their heroin use
into their life.
Like, they're totally productive and cool lives. And in the middle of this, she crawls across the floor to go puke in a garbage can.
Well, here's a dumb question. What do I know her from other than The Sopranos?
That would be ER.
ER, there you go. All right. Boy, she is just smoking. And not traditionally my type, but boy, she is just beautiful beyond words. There is no, and I got to tell you, and I, speaking of the Stones and Keith and all that stuff, I got to admit though, there is a certain sort of horrible, junky sexiness to all of that, the way that they did that.
And yeah.
I mean, they're on the couch, sitting in their own filth, basically.
Yeah.
She's vomiting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm still watching it going, that's pretty sexy. You know, I just, I don't know what it is, man. It's a, there's a certain...
You need a meeting, my friend.
Yeah, there's a certain seductive evil to that.
It was a very cool, you know, and everything about that episode was just so, and it was just beautiful and wrenching in
yeah.
a way, just because it was like every single person on that show was so deluded about themselves, just so absolutely out of touch with reality, you know. And every, and the sort of the apotheosis moment was went during that sit down or whatever they wanted to call it, where Tony was talking to Phil from the New York gang, and they're both deeply aggrieved at one another,
right?
And little Carmine's there in the middle.
Oh, God.
And they're both irked because, like, Phil had knocked off Gay Vito. And Tony's guys took out Fat Dom, you know, who sort of like as revenge because he came over and was busting balls. But then meanwhile, and so they're both pretending that they have nothing to do with either one of those things.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, and then little Carmine says something about how he just recently lost Rusty, who, of course, Phil had knocked off.
Right.
But none of them will admit,
right,
like, in the light of the day, that they had anything to do with it. Except now that I think of it, I think Phil does basically own up to the fact that he and his boys beat Vito.
Well, and again, it's that whole thing where everybody knows, but no one will say.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that the dynamic on that show. And I really still do miss Johnny Sack because I love that guy so much. But Phil has his own brand of that guy is snaky and intimidating. He's terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and speaking of terrifying, there was that beautiful moment after Carmella had been sort of wheedling Tony about what happened to Adriana, mm-hmm, we gotta get mm-hmm. detective and all this, but the moment he got her going on the spec house,
oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
She instantly forgot all about it.
Well, and there's that moment where she's going through her business cards,
yeah.
And she just sees and she goes, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, tosses it away.
Yeah.
And you know she knows.
Yeah, exactly.
You know she knows.
Yeah.
She is almost like Tony, flirting with the idea of actually doing the right thing.
Yep.
But when presented with some other kind of advantage, screw the right thing.
Yep, yep.
You know,
yep.
What's that got to do? You know, screw it. I'll do this other thing instead.
And then Christopher, who is, of course, sleeping with Juliana Margulies, who has spurned Tony's advances.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all going to... And meanwhile, they're all scum, of course. We all know that these are bad people, but it's weird how... Like you made that observation about how Vito got killed, but he kind of had it coming because he shot that one guy.
In the back of the head.
And it's like, right. You know, but they've all shot, like every one of these characters, they've all killed a dozen people. And it's weird how we sort of make that delineation in our head, because I'm looking at Christopher, who's stepping out on his pregnant wife, and I'm like, oh, look at that guy, he's scum, he's stepping on his wife, overlooking the fact that he's probably killed 30 people.
Yeah. Well, who was the one character who did a decent thing last night?
It was AJ.
That's right. And he figured out the way, despite, you know, everyone else is a mystery. You know, he was over at his girlfriend's house, and they were blasting, and these kids outside were blasting their boombox and waking up her 3-year-old.
Right.
She said, like, well, her husband or her ex-husband, when he was still around, used to go out and beat the crap out of him.
Right.
And so, you know, he kind of has to go out and do something, but you know he's not man enough to take on 3 thugs. So he gets his bike and gives it to them. And, like, and they're sort of tickled by that.
Right,
You think they're just going to hit club him with the bike or something.
But in that moment, though, you learn everything about that kid, which is that, you know, that he wants to avoid the confrontation, and maybe he's not, you know, kind of a bad kid or a thug. But you also learn, you also in that moment realize that no matter how much he may ever decide he wants it, he can never step into Tony's role. He just doesn't have it in him.
I don't think he wants it. I mean, I think it's the only thing that he knows, but, I mean, I think... You know, theoretically, what came out in that episode for the very first time was what a sweetie he really is.
Right, right.
He's not completely venal, and they sort of flirted with that as a character trait.
Right.
But he's not. He's actually kind of he's a sweetie.
And what's up with Meadow just being written off the show almost?
Yeah.
Well, listen to you just written her. I don't care.
They've done a lot with Meadow over the years. I think they're just sick of her.
Yeah, maybe.
So, you know, and who knows? I mean, I don't know if that. I mean,
she had that weird divorce in real life.
Yeah.
So maybe she's just become or whatever. So this is it. So we're done until with The Sopranos until January now, right?
Yeah, more or less.
And it's
they just said 2007. The early buzz is January, but you know how these things go.
Well, because last night was a Christmas episode, it indicated to me that maybe the original plan was to start rolling these out in, like, October or something.
Yeah, but those first episodes, it was the first season that really didn't adhere to one particular season. It bounced right around. Like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, it was still, like, early fall, and then suddenly, boom, week, you know, 2 months went by.
All right. So we've got that. So what I'd like to do is we got the Sopranos, and then next week we should talk about what the networks are going to be rolling out for their new lineup. We should start to maybe go over that a little bit because there's been there's that new Aaron Sorkin show coming out, and there's just been a whole litany of things coming down the pike, as it were.
Yeah.
So maybe next week we can talk a bit about what they're going to be foisting upon us this year.
Wasting
and
yeah.
So forth. What is happening in the Oregonian that people should know about, Peter Carlin?
That's all classified. What's happening in the Oregonian? I don't know. I'm actually at home today. You mean what am I?
Like what in the world of what is Peter Carlin working on that people should be reading?
Ooh, wow.
I actually haven't checked the paper today, so you probably have something stunning in there that I haven't
but
read.
But you did see the Sopranos piece on Saturday, right?
Yes.
All right. You would have been interested in that.
And apparently you've left coin broken and bleeding and battered, so you're not going to...
People, your friends downstairs.
No, I don't care. You're going to go back and finish them off at some point? Did somebody at Coin steal your lunch money as a child, or...
No, it was just, you know, it was an interesting story.
It doesn't matter to me. I don't care. I'm just saying it was like the first, it's the biggest piece you've ever done, isn't it? This the piece on Coin?
You mean the five-part series?
The five-part series, which we read, by the way, with glee and gusto every day on the air.
No, you did not.
I did, Sarah.
The whole thing.
Sarah, you are my witness. Well, we read excerpts.
We didn't read the whole thing.
We read particularly brutal excerpts every day.
You... Well, I thought it was just an interesting sort of industry type piece about
it was
illustrated sort of larger trends and blah 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 blah.
No, it was fascinating.
Plus, also there was such rage and shrieking and moaning going on every side, and everyone was going on such brutal misunderstandings of one another, and people were behaving so badly on every side, it was irresistible.
No, there was a lot of. Oh, wait, I hear Sarah's actually just started.
Sorry,
the music
we actually,
here.
Yeah, we're going to run right to the end. We've got a break.
So we'll have you on maybe next Monday. We'll talk about what's coming up in the world of television.
Aidy.
All right, Peter Carlin, read him in print in the Oregonian online at OregonLive.com. Thank you, Peter.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, there you go.
Bye.
That's Peter Carlin. All right, it's 503-733-2970. Back after this, like us at 3, world famous Phil Hendry Show. We'll wrap up the Rick Emerson Show after this. You stay right there. It's Veruca Salt. We now enter the saddest part of the broadcasting day, the final segment of the Rick Emerson Show. Coming up at 3, right here on AM 970, Salad State Radio. It's on Likas World Famous Phil Hendry Show at 7. We are now 27 hours away from Horns Across the Hawthorn. I encourage you, tell everybody you know, email your friends, email your enemies, email whatever. You can find out more at 970.am. You can also go to rickemerson.com or to one of our myriad MySpace pages. You go to rickemerson.com, and there on the right-hand side, you'll see a whole list of MySpace links. You can find all that there. So that's happening tomorrow. Tomorrow, 5:30, meeting at the Grassy Knoll just below the northwest pedestrian entrance to the Hawthorne Bridge. We will gather there, and then at 6:06, we do the picture. You get your backstage laminate souvenir thing. That gets you a spin on the Pentagram of Prizes at Dante's afterwards. So go find out all the information. It's at rickemerson.com. It is happening tomorrow, my friends. Don't forget, we're going to be giving away... thing in my throat there. You're going to be giving away the first batch of merchandise for AM 970, brand new shirts, which are fantastic looking. And we're also going to be giving away 6 minutes of the Rick Emerson Show, during which you can do whatever you want. So that is all happening tomorrow, followed by Clyde Lewis and his 666 gathering, etc. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we will be counting down to Horns Across the Hawthorne. Wednesday, Marky Ramone. We will be talking to Marky Ramone on the show. That happens Wednesday. Thursday, I think we have Roller Derby Girls on Thursday for some reason. We didn't come up with a name for the street team. We got to do that tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll find a better name for the AM 970 street team because I can't abide something called a street team. All right, we want to thank CNN radio correspondent Lisa Goddard, also Clyde Lewis, also Peter Carlin from the Oregonian. The Rick Emerson Show produced today and every day by the lovely and talented Sarah X. Dillon for AM 970 Solid State Radio in the newsroom. Tim Riley. Man in charge of all beeping things is Sean Couples. So we thank you for coming by. Like us next. World famous Phil Hendry Show at 7. We'll see you all in 21 hours, noon tomorrow, and tomorrow for Horns Across the Hawthorne. As always, thank you for listening. Don't let the bastards grind it down. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye.
one big fiesta for illegal aliens and homosexuals.